Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Usual two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Max Isle, keeper of the Jubonics blog, on the street protests in Israel. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from a frequent guest in this show, Yanis Varoufakis, on the latest developments in the European economic crisis, which are, you will be surprised to learn, not so good. Before that, a report on some recent economic research. The economic news is pretty simple. More of the same. Slowdown met with austerity. Old story. Not much to update there. But speaking of austerity, I thought a summary of a very timely paper by two economists, Jacopo Ponticelli and Hans-Joachim Voth, would be in order. The conclusion of their paper, which is not your typical economic fare, austerity has tended to go hand in hand with politically motivated violence and social instability. Clearly, the recent riots in Britain are just the latest episode in an ancient story. Ponticelli and Voth, who are both affiliated with the Universitat Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona, assemble instances of demonstrations, riots, strikes, assassinations, and attempted revolutions into a composite variable they call chaos. They find that austerity programs, particularly budget cuts, increase the level of chaos. As they say, expenditure cuts wreak havoc. Across Europe, the general level of protest and riot was very high in the years just after World War II. Things calmed down from the early 1950s to the late 1960s, but then got bubbly again between 1968 and 1994. Then the mood turned more tranquil between 1994 and 2009, a period that correlates with what economists used to call the Great Moderation, the dampening of the business cycle that neoliberalism was once thought to have brought about. Clearly, that's all changed with the onset of the Great Recession, the Euro crisis, and all the austerity and popular discontent that's come with them. What about the U.S.? Alas, Ponticelli and Voth have nothing to say about this country, and there's no similar research done by others. But austerity is just beginning here. We do have a more quiescent population, though that wasn't always the case, and more repressive cops than they do in Europe. But will this brand of American exceptionalism continue to hold? Back after a musical break to hear about protest in Israel, a place where there's been a lot of austerity over the last couple of decades. That was some of the Bourré from the Suite for Unaccompanied Cello by Bach, performed by Mieczysław Rostropowicz. My first guest today is Max Isle, that's spelled A-J-L. Max Isle writes frequently on Israel and other Middle Eastern topics and is studying development sociology at Cornell. He blogs at Max Isle, that's M-A-X-A-J-L, .com, a.k.a. Jubonics. I thought he was a good guy to check in with to explain what's going on with the massive protests in Israel. 250,000 people in the streets, a tent city on the fanciest drag in Tel Aviv, and so on. The protests are being called the J-14 movement after July 14th, when it all took off. That letter number name makes it feel like 2000 all over again. Apologies, but this week's show is plagued by some bad phones on the other end. This one in rural Massachusetts, okay, Wellfleet, and the next in Greece. Here's Max Isle. Welcome, Max. First of all, let's talk about the immediate genesis of the protests and then talk about some of the broader structural interests behind them. How'd hundreds of thousands of Israelis end up in the streets?
Well, it started when a filmmaker in Tel Aviv named Daphne Leaf was met with a hike in her rent, and she could not afford to pay it. So she decided, taking up kind of the regional spirit, to go out into the street and do a sit-in against the government protesting the price of rent. She did a Facebook group calling on her countrymen to join her, and a lot of them did. And to the surprise of just about everybody, the movement has massively increased to the point where last Saturday, a week and a half ago, Saturday, there were approximately 250 or 300,000 people in Tel Aviv, which is just a massive protest.
And was there any conscious influence coming from Egypt and the rest of the Arab Spring?
There was, and this is being under-remarked upon from various sides, unfortunately. You see people actually holding up signs in Arabic saying, go. You see people speaking about the spirit of Tahrir. There's all kinds of things that indicate that this kind of spirit of the Arab Spring, this kind of infectious energy of revolt, has spread.
Obviously, a great deal of Israeli culture has been borrowed or taken from the surrounding region, but this is a kind of very much a self-conscious borrowing. So someone on TV was talking publicly about the spirit of Tahrir infecting them. They're saying we are self-consciously copying and emulating the Arab model. So what that says about the kind of embryonic transformation of consciousness is something very bright and hopeful. One wouldn't want to make too much of it yet, but this is something that you are very rarely seen in Israel. On the other side, the surrounding Arabs, especially in Egypt, a lot of them are annoyed at the idea that the Israelis are copying them. But this kind of speaks more to Arab nationalism at the current moment, especially in Egypt.
Drawing this similarity also says something about Israeli society. Does that mean it is ossified, deeply hierarchical, authoritarian in the same way that, the Egypt of Mubarak is?
I would say it's enormously hierarchical. I mean, even not including the Palestinian Arabs in the occupied territories, Israel is the second most unequal industrialized economy in the world. If you include them, it's kind of off the charts. So in that sense, there's massive hierarchy. I mean, most of the country is just owned by a handful of families. It's just an enormously stratified economy. So there is a great deal of hierarchy in that sense. In the political sense, not so much in terms of the Jewish population. For the Jewish population, in many ways, it's still a democracy, although there are creeping laws. They are attempting to criminalize any form of boycott from Israeli citizens against their own country. So there's signs of, there are certain methods being taken to undercut freedom of speech and freedom of expression. But for them, it's a democracy. Obviously, for the Arab population, it's never been a democracy, and it'll take a lot of change before it becomes one.
Let's talk a bit more about the structure of the Israeli economy. There's, of course, the classic story is that it used to be socialist and it's gotten neoliberalized over the last couple of decades. The old heroic days of the kibbutz are gone, and now it's a bunch of driving electronics entrepreneurs and pharmaceutical entrepreneurs. Israel has joined the globalized world. What of that story is true and what isn't?
Not so much of it's true, especially the beginning. Israel definitely did a good job of marketing itself as a socialist success story. Probably a lot of that had to do with the fact that a lot of the economic development was funneled through the state, and a lot of the foreign currency flows were also routed through the state. So given the linkage, historical linkage kind of what we think of as socialism with state-guided development, that kind of helped create this connotation of socialism. But from the very beginning, even from the say 1925, investments in Israel were offering massive profit opportunities for foreign investors. I mean, people were making returns of 5, 8, 10% a year. And what happened was that because of the evolution of Israeli capitalism went hand in hand with the process of settler colonial state formation, they were able to both offer profits for investors and create a kind of burgeoning upper class, and at the same time distribute the proceeds from what they stole from the Palestinians to the lower and middle classes and make everyone richer while keeping the country relatively egalitarian, which it was until maybe 1960, at which point things started to become increasingly polarized and got to the point where we are today. And I would say that process really started hitting its peak in the late 70s. As the kind of model of militarized accumulation started to show its age, and then the country underwent a massive bout of hyperinflation, running in the hundreds of percent annually at one point. And by the end of it, about a tiny fraction of the population was holding a massive portion of the economy. And it was at that point that the neoliberal reforms were put in place, a kind of standard package, very much akin to what was put in place in Latin America. And at that point, the wealth distributions really started becoming increasingly stratified and polarized.
And who are the political figures associated with that neoliberalization?
It went on under both parties. I mean, it was kind of an agreement between both Labor and Likud. People that would be familiar as students of neoliberal political economy, like Fisher and other people, were brought in, and consultants from the IMF and World Bank were brought in order to put in place this package. So it was just kind of very much the standard apparatus.
Fisher is now the head of the Israeli Central Bank, right?
Yeah.
So he was a major figure at the World Bank and the IMF, and now he is presiding over Israeli monetary policy.
Right, which just gives you a sense of how much tightly Israel is integrated into the global capital markets at this point. It's one of the highest levels of integration in the world.
And now what about the structure of the domestic economy? What are the leading sectors, and what about its ownership structures?
The leading sectors, a great portion of it, as is well known, is under the military. I mean, historically, between 9 and up to 30 or 35% of GDP has been spent on the military. Right now, it's running at, I think, around 16%. A portion of that is still owned by the state, but a lot of it has been privatized in recent years. And so it's owned by certain groups like COR and the Ofer Brothers and just kind of various cartels. And they're kind of notorious, I mean, just because there's so few of them and they're so identified with the commanding heights of the Israeli economy. On the other hand, you also have foreign investors. You have people like Bronfman, which is a name that should be well known, especially to people in New York, and which has been heavily affiliated with the Birthright Program, the Birthright Israel Program, to send young American Jews to Israel. So you have all these, a predominant number of Jewish American investors who have kind of bought into the Israeli economy in recent years, starting in the early to mid-90s, and kind of brought it under their control and created these even tighter links between Israel and America. And then finally, you have kind of massive IT corporations, a great deal of European telecom. You have companies like Intel. You have American Telecom, Motorola. And they've also either from the early 1970s have had massive investments in Israel. And lately, especially again, starting in the early 90s, those investments have broadened and deepened, and to the point where they've both bought up a lot of the industrial plant that was developed in Israel, and they also just created new investments because Israel offers these massive subsidies and basically tax breaks, just total giveaways to these companies so that they build industrial plant within Israel. The most notorious is Intel, which was effectively guaranteed at a certain period something like a 33% annual return on its investment.
So you have these big international names and a bunch of relatively small number of local plutocrats, but what does the Israeli economy mean for the broad mass of the population?
For the broad mass of the population, they are living quite badly. About a third of the population is making something like the minimum wage, and then there's another 45-50% that's not making too much money either, and they've been making less and less. And the Israeli costs of living are quite high. I mean, they're not so much lower to those that might prevail in New York or, you know, elsewhere in the West in Europe. But a lot of the amenities that are taken for granted in the industrialized West don't exist in Israel. So there's no functioning public transportation system. In spite of all this IT development, you know, the universities are not wired properly for wireless, to say nothing of, you know, the way that the people who are much poorer are living, where the social safety net is totally frayed for them. And not only that, but if they live in the north or the south, they're under perpetual threat from the kind of militaristic environment that the Israeli elite constantly foments by its own activities.
And now, are we speaking of the Jewish population?
No, the irony is that it's actually the Jewish population. It's the Arab-Jewish population in the north and the south that are, you know, most under threat from the retaliation to Israeli militarism from Palestinians or the Lebanese.
And I happened recently to be looking at some of the international education statistics from the OECD, and I noted that Israel scores rather poorly on reading and math, which certainly contradicts one's cliched understanding of Jews. But any idea why the educational system is performing so poorly?
Yeah, well, starting in at least the early 90s, I mean, state spending started getting redirected to more narrow sectors, and the fact is not everyone in the population is going to be an engineer, and not everyone in the population is going to be a professor, and so there's no point in training the entire population so that they're prepared for these very highly skilled professional tasks from the perspective of the elite. So the result has been a kind of fraying and deteriorating educational infrastructure. You know, for the elite, there are still plenty of opportunities. Increasingly, they've been going to private school, and then they go on to get a good education at universities. And so they have historically and continue to be well prepared for elite jobs. But for the rest of the population, they've been the recipients of decreasing amounts of funding from the state in terms of their educational institutions. And so their achievements reflect that.
I'm speaking with the writer, journalist Max Isle. So this is the backdrop to the social explosion we've seen over the last few weeks. What kind of people are in the streets? What's the demographics of the protest?
I would say it's across the board. It started off with a lot of the former middle class or upper middle class, so meaning predominantly Ashkenazi people of Jewish European extraction. More recently, they've been spreading into the poor kind of Arab Jewish communities, and these are the communities that typically vote for the more right-wing parties. And finally, there have also been complaints and people participating in the tent protests from the Palestinian Arab communities, which is the most hopeful sign, because if these communities can be effectively mobilized alongside the Jewish population in the tent protests, then you have at least the social base for a totally non-sectarian movement. But whether or not that will be borne out by reality, we have to see.
Now, when you have a group of people that diverse, what kind of political analysis or agenda emerges from this formation, or are they just kind of avoiding those sorts of questions?
They are very purposely avoiding the issue of the occupation. Initially, one could certainly understand this as an attempt to kind of keep the protest movement together and allow this consciousness to develop slowly and let people see that their common interest is in fighting neoliberalism and attempt to use that common interest to kind of bring them to a higher level of consciousness and understand that the occupation is also part of the domestic class structure, even within the Jewish community within Israel. So a lot of organizers have been very consciously attempting to keep the issue of the occupation off the table, especially because as soon as someone will bring up the occupation, then the government will attempt to just dismiss the protesters and say, oh, this is a typical bunch of left-wing anti-Israeli rabble-rousers and we should ignore them and these people are seditious and trying to destroy Israel. So this hasn't worked, which is significant. On the other hand, if the occupation is never on the table, then effectively it's very hard to bring militarism into the picture. And if neither militarism nor occupation are on the table, then it's very hard to have any substantive structural change within the Israeli class structure, because it's through militarism and occupation that resources are diverted from the bottom to the top of Israeli society.
Of course, one doesn't want to liken the situation of the Israeli middle and working class to the occupied territories. You say in your Truth Out piece that the occupation is an instrument of domestic social control, a way of controlling and incorporating the lower classes within Israel. Could you expand on that?
Yeah. I think it has several factors. I mean, it has to be looked at in the first sense historically. So you have to look at what happened in 1967 as the occupation was deepened. Immediately, labor flows of Palestinians went from the occupied territories into Israel and filled up the kind of lower rungs of the occupational ladder. So with those people, with those rungs filled, the people who had previously occupied those positions, which were primarily the Arab Jews, were suddenly pushed up. And so the influx of a new lower class gave them a lot of social prestige in the first place. And any attempt to end the occupation meant, at least symbolically to them, and perhaps in practice, that they would suddenly be dumped into the bottom of the social hierarchy. That's the first thing. The second thing is that in the current kind of moral economy of Israeli society, before these tent protests, politics were effectively taken off the table. So the only way to compete for prestige for the lower class, whose economic opportunities have been totally foreclosed to them, was to be racist. And this is why Israeli society has been increasingly racist. So you have the Arab Jews being much more racist than the Ashkenazi founders, at least outwardly. And then you have people talking about these new Russian Jews who brought in this racism from Russia. And this is a total fabrication. And these groups are enormously racist, but again, this is how you compete for social prestige within Israel, through hatred of the other, hatred of the external enemy. And so this kind of binds everyone together. Everyone either pretends or is in reality scared of the external enemy, not noticing that there's also an enemy within their community who's robbing them dry. And so this is kind of reflected in the entire Israeli educational apparatus. So there's an Israeli scholar, Nurit Pellet Elhanan, who's been carrying out investigations of Israeli school books, which are just tremendously racist. They're just drenched in racism towards the Arab population. And so this is meant to, as a means of social control, and just to keep them focused on the external enemy as opposed to the enemy within. And there's also more basic material factors contributing. There's the land, and people want the land, so they take the land. And it's, if they're not bound by any moral strictures on stealing the land from the Palestinians, then they just take it. It's good land, and they want to live there. The Israeli government also has set up a situation in which the only new affordable housing within Israel is primarily within the settlements, both, you know, near the Green Line or the pre-67 armistice line, and also in East Jerusalem. So they've just been building steadily more and more houses and apartments in those places, and they're much cheaper, and you can get a lot more for your money there than you can get in central Tel Aviv or in the downtowns of other cities. So, of course, people want to go live there. If they were offered housing, if they had been offered housing in elsewhere in Israel at affordable rates and comparable housing, of course they would have taken it. And this also creates constituencies in terms of the people who build those things. So the construction companies benefit from continued occupation, and finally the military gets very invested in occupation as well. So there's just a top-to-bottom consensus on occupation. So if you look at the polls about the number of people who want withdrawal from the occupied territories, it's almost none. And so you hear about these peace proposals, but you look at the polls, and if you look at what is actually contemplated in terms of what people think would be a just peace, they don't even think about withdrawing from the territories they've occupied as part of that peace. There's not even necessarily the consciousness of them being illegal occupiers. They just have this land and they want to take it, and everyone agrees that that's the right thing to do. It was the right thing to do. It is the right thing to do, and it will be the right thing to do. And with this kind of communal consensus, it's very hard to mobilize people on a class basis.
And much of the support for Netanyahu and the other right-wing figures in Israeli politics comes from the poorer parts of society, right?
Right. Especially, you know, Netanyahu and the Shas party, which is kind of the Arab-Jewish party historically, both of them draw quite a lot of support from the Arab Jews. And that's basically because they are slightly more in favor of the occupation than the labor parties. And because of that, they're able to kind of develop and cultivate this constituency amongst the poorer population, which understands the occupation historically as a route to social advancement. So, as well as a way for them to kind of defend their identity and as, you know, pseudo-Westerners against the Arabs they're oppressing. So there's this kind of this perfect top-to-bottom alignment between both what the elites of the right-wing parties want, which is continued occupation, because that's where they're mostly in invested and what the rank and file want with also continued occupation.
So what does this leave at prospects for the J-14 upsurge? Is this a lot of good feelings and pious wishes that are going to crash on the structural reality of the fissures of Israeli society and the need for continuing war and occupation?
It's hard to say. I would not want to be unduly optimistic about the prospects of these protests. As with any protests, they can go much further than anyone expected them to go, and especially, of course, the Israelis have the innate capacity at some level to understand the links between occupation and militarism and capitalism, because those links are real. But if they've been indoctrinated and brainwashed their entire lives to believe otherwise. So the question of if they can develop that consciousness in a week or in a month or in 2 months or in 6 months is an open question. And there isn't enough time for them to develop that consciousness. There's going to be, the occupation is already coming up as a dividing issue. And it's going to come up even more so in September when the Palestinians go to the UN and try and declare a state. And so the question of where they stand on the occupation is just going to be a dividing line. I mean, reservists are going to be called up from all these tents, and they're going to be called upon to repress the Palestinians. And the government, meanwhile, will be hoping that that works out, and if it doesn't, they'll try and wait them out otherwise. So I think that it would be great if something good came out of these protests. And especially if I were living within Israel and I were, an anti-capitalist leftist, I would be heavily involved in trying to articulate these protests with anti-occupation and anti-Zionist sentiment. But the difficulty of doing so is enormous. And for that reason, the overriding Palestinian sentiment has been to not use the existence of these protests as an excuse to let up the pressure on the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign, because the Israeli left has a very long and very sordid history of talking against the occupation, but in fact doing nothing about it. And if these protests just allow the Israeli left to re-legitimize itself in the eyes of Israeli society and kind of reassume its historic role as talking about the occupation being bad but not doing anything against the occupation, the Palestinians will be the ones left holding the bag.
That was Max Eil. That's spelled A-J-L. Max Eil writes frequently on Israel and other Middle Eastern topics and is studying development sociology at Cornell. He blogs at maxeil.com. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of the first movement, the Allemande, from Bach's Partita for Solo Flute, performed by Jean-Pierre Rampal. My next guest is making his eighth appearance on Behind the News, Yannis Varoufakis, a professor of economics at the University of Athens. I first called on him back in December 2008, when Greece was exploding with riotous protests against neoliberalism. But he's become my go-to guy for analysis of the crisis of the Eurozone, which just keeps getting worse. Greece has fallen out of the headlines and is now being replaced by Spain and Italy as crisis central. The crisis is the inevitable result of the structure of the entire Euro project, shoehorning countries as different as Germany and Greece, the Netherlands and Spain, France and Italy, all into the same economic space. In that list I just made, the first country in each pair is richer, more technologically advanced, and more productive than the second. But by placing them all into the same currency zone, and with no central fiscal authority or government to even things out, there's a profound structural contradiction. In the old days, the drachma, the peseta, and the lira could all sink in value relative to the Deutschmark, the guilder, and the franc, thereby easing the competitive pressure on the weaker members. Not so anymore. There's no central bank in Athens, Madrid, or Rome that can pump funds into the markets and keep an economy in crisis afloat. While the national central banks still exist, they're mainly regulators, with the real action now all at the headquarters of the European Central Bank in Frankfurt, which is now the world's leading outpost of sadomonetarism. Yanis Varoufakis has an excellent scheme for resolving the euro crisis, which he's outlined in earlier appearances here. It boils down to this. The European authorities could issue bonds to fund the purchase of the debt of the peripheral countries in crisis. The debtor countries would service those bonds at considerably lower interest rates than they're forced to pay now, since panicked investors don't want to touch Greek bonds. The interest rate on 10-year Greek government bonds is over 16%. For comparable German bonds, it's around 3%. The U.S., the downgraded subject of much worry, is yielding around 2%. Japan, the multiply downgraded alleged basket case, is around 1%. Markets can be funny. Also, Yanis says, the European authorities must find a way to channel funds from the countries running large surpluses, like Germany, to those running chronic trade deficits, like Greece and Ireland, so they can invest, develop, and pull themselves up to something closer to German levels. Otherwise, the Eurozone will break apart with potentially catastrophic consequences. Okay, here's Yanis Varoufakis. Welcome, Yanis. I imagine that someday we'll call you when there's good news, but not right now. The immediate crisis in Greece seems to have receded from the headlines, but now it seems to be spreading westward. Well, how serious are the problems in Italy and Spain, in your view?
Catastrophic. Italy and Spain are burning down. They are today where Greece was around March of 2010. The problem is that their size and significance is much, much greater. So whereas Greece was a pipsqueak, which nevertheless stirred big waves, Italy and Spain are of the size that will guarantee, unless we change our course here in the Eurozone, in Europe, that the European project will be dead and buried.
Italy's debt is mostly domestic, right?
That's correct, but Greece's debt was mostly domestic. The problem with Italy is that it resembles a bloated case of Greece, even though the north of Italy is a serious economy, unlike the Greek economy. They're industrialized, well-run, free of corruption, mostly free of corruption, sub-economy within Italy. Nevertheless, Italy as a whole suffers from exactly the same symptoms that Greece did a year and a half ago. That is, a large debt-to-GDP ratio, and primarily an economy that has stalled. Because let's not forget that Greece has had a very large debt-to-GDP ratio for a long, long time, but it managed to continue along a path of relative stability for decades, courtesy of a reasonable growth rate. Greece had a growth rate between 3 and 5% for 15, 18 years. It was when that growth rate turned negative, or went to zero initially and then went negative, that the debt burden became a factor and the country ended up in the mire in which it finds itself. Italy is in exactly the same situation now. They have a debt-to-GDP ratio which is in excess of 120%. That has always been the case in Italy. Italy has had a large debt-to-GDP ratio, but it was being kept at bay. Well, the debt crisis was being kept at bay by a reasonable growth rate. Now it has stagnated. Once a run on the bonds of a Eurozone country begins, courtesy of a slowdown of the economy, then the economy will slow down further and the run on the bonds is going to get worse. And this is unfortunate, given that we don't have the capacity in the Eurozone, effectively we don't print our own money, to refinance our debts during a run on the bonds of a Eurozone country. The only natural outcome of this process is collapse, unless, of course, the Eurozone restructures.
Now, this is an important point. Financial crises generally follow slowdowns in growth. I think a lot of people think that financial crises are the overtures to a problem, but it's nothing like a slowdown in growth to bring out an underlying financial problem.
That's correct. That's correct. The problem with the Eurozone countries is that they don't have their own currencies, which means that bond markets become extremely flighty and extremely panicky, because the moment they realize that they are selling your bonds and you cannot print money in order to cover your bonds, And the only way you can continue repaying or servicing your bonds is by borrowing money on condition of austerity, which reduces your capacity to pay because austerity brings about a reduction in GDP. Then this is a vicious circle, and both the bond markets and the member state, the Eurozone member state in question, are caught in the wake of this vicious circle, and the only way is down from that moment onwards.
And moving on to Spain, as I recall, the Spanish debt is far more weighted towards the private sector rather than government debt. Am I right?
Correct. Spain, this is a very interesting case because we hear constantly commentators and politicians blaming this crisis on lack of fiscal discipline. Well, Spain was a very good example of exactly the opposite. Spain had a lower debt-to-GDP ratio than Germany. In 2008, when the great financial disaster hit us all globally, Spain was running a surplus of its government budget. The reason why it finds itself in the situation in which it is in is because of profligacy of the private sector, in particular of developers and banks. The same story as in the rest of the Anglo-Saxon world, in the Anglo-Saxon world, in Ireland, in Britain, and to a large extent in the United States. And what happened was that the state, like everywhere else, took it to itself to guarantee the creditors of the banks and of the developers, as opposed to guaranteeing the deposits in the banks and the homeowners. The usual story. And because the Spanish state is not capable of trading its own money, at some point a run on its bonds began, especially when the domino effect, which began with Greece, shifted to Ireland, then moved to Portugal, next door to Spain, and hit Italy and Spain simultaneously. Interestingly, compare and contrast, as we speak, Britain and Spain. Britain and Spain are comparable economies in terms of population, size, dynamism, and so on and so forth. Spain has a much lower debt-to-GDP ratio than Britain. Spain has a lower deficit, budget deficit than Britain, and yet Spain has to pay a premium over what Britain does in order to borrow from the money market of 3.5% more. Why? Because it is caught in this euro system, which was never designed, as I keep saying, to sustain the great financial crisis, or any financial crisis.
It seems that there's a consensus among elites around the world that the goal of public policy should be to protect creditors and make sure that they get paid 100 cents on the dollar, and everything else seems to take a distant second and third place compared to that. Is that my perception correct?
Absolutely. It's the reason why both on both sides of the Atlantic we find ourselves in the midst of a debt crisis which is spinning out of control. The common fate has been of both the United States and of Europe that after the great disaster of 2008, our governments, both the United States government and Europe, tried valiantly to save, to salvage shareholders of the banks and creditors of the banks instead of guaranteeing the deposits of banks and doing something about the homeowners whose homes were being foreclosed. The problem is, and we've known that, because, you know, both Washington and Brussels and Frankfurt and London and Paris and Berlin were criticizing Japan in the 1990s for doing exactly what is happening now. We've always known that if in the middle of a debt crisis you guarantee the creditors of a bank and the shareholders of a bank, and not just of a bank, of the banking system as a whole, you turn this banking system into a black hole, into a zombie banking system, which is insolvent. But liquid, it is insolvent because its assets are such that it has negative equity. So it knows that it is insolvent. So whatever liquidity comes its way from the government and from individuals and entrepreneurs, that liquidity is being withheld by the banks. It's not being lent out to businesses and households. And the result is that the banking system of your nation, of your trading bloc, like in the Eurozone, turns out to be a black hole that simply sucks the energy, the economic energy and value from all other sectors of the economy. And that manifests itself as a major debt crisis of the sovereign, of the state. And then you have politicians on both sides of the Atlantic, Republicans mainly in your neck of the woods, but social democrats, to a large extent here in the European Union, ironically, who say that the solution to this is austerity. And what does austerity do? It forces families and businesses to deleverage further, to reduce their spending, to try to reduce their debts. And when everybody's doing the same thing, aggregate demand falls further, and this means that the debt crisis gets worse.
Now, speaking of austerity, another difference with Britain is that it's embraced a voluntary austerity program. It's gotten some riots in response to it, but the markets seem to be somewhat tranquilized by Britain's promise of budget cutting in the months and years ahead. What do you think of the British policy that they think they can get through it on the basis of austerity?
They're not getting through it. Already the labor market in Britain is not working. Mrs. Thatcher won her first election in 1979 on the slogan, labor isn't working. Now, under the Tories and the Lib Dems, it's the labor market that's not working. We see that it is producing fewer vacancies, more unemployment claims, industrial production is coming down. This is not the way to get out of a debt crisis. This whole British situation now is reminding what Winston Churchill said. If you remember, he had said that appeasement is all about feeding the dragon, hoping that the dragon will eat you last. And this is what Britain has been doing, hoping against hope that Europe, China, and the United States would grow, and that it would be able to free ride on their coattails through budget deficit reduction, spending, government spending reduction. Unfortunately, everybody's doing the same thing, except perhaps for China. And aggregate demand is like a tide going out, leaving behind it a few weedy posts and mud. And that's the situation that the labor markets find themselves in, both in the United States, in Britain, and, of course, in the Eurozone.
I'm speaking with Yanis Varoufakis, a professor of economics at the University of Athens. And until recently, the German economy had looked pretty strong. It looked like Germany was immune to the crisis that its neighbors were suffering. But now Germany is slowing down. What do you make of what's happening there?
It's hardly surprising. Following 2008, the Great Recession, Germany found itself in a situation where GDP shrank very fast. But nevertheless, the stimulus package that was introduced in China by the Chinese authorities meant that, on the one hand, consumption fell precipitously in China, but investment rose at the same rate, even faster rate. That's why China keeps growing. Its GDP is growing, even though its consumption percentage has dropped something like a little bit to 33%. Now, all these infrastructural investments translated into demand for German capital goods, machinery. And Germany received a major boost from that at a time when all the other Eurozone countries, and indeed the United States, were suffering. And that, in conjunction with the corporatist model of Germany, which corporate that labor agreed to significant pay reductions over a period of 10 years, actually, before the crisis. So the effectively, wages as the total percentage of GDP fell. In exchange, and what did the trade unions get in exchange for that? They got a better distribution of that decreasing share of the pie amongst workers, so unemployment fell. The companies hoarded labor, but paid them less. In view of this, when the Chinese demand for machinery rose, the workers were already in the factories. They simply had to crank up the production lines. And Germany benefited significantly from that. And its rate of growth after the major slump of 2008-2009 was quite admirable by Western standards. But this was a demand that was completely and utterly created by this combination of factors, the Chinese stimulus, the local corporatist circumstances which allowed for a distribution of income away from wages and towards profits, towards returns to capital, and the fact that the Eurozone continued to support the German industry, at least to some extent, through demand for its consumption goods as opposed to production goods, capital goods. But that could not possibly continue, especially as the Eurozone crisis in periphery deepens. Demand for German products in Italy, in Spain, in Ireland, even in Britain with its own recessionary forces doing the work there, Greece, and you may laugh when I say Greece, but let me tell you that Greece had the largest number of Porsche Cayennes bought in the last 4 years before the crisis in Europe. Well, they had continuing fewer consumption goods coming from Germany. So it was inevitable that Germany would not be immune. It was a temporary fillip that it received primarily from China. As if China enters a period of slowdown, then Germany is going to find itself in an extremely difficult situation. And I'm saying this because the cooperative model, this alliance between labor unions and German capital, has produced a great deal of discontent amongst working Germans. Working Germans benefited from the reduction of unemployment because they were not unemployed, but at the same time they turned into working poor. The percentage of the poverty rate in Germany amongst working Germans increased. That led to a significant rise in discontent. Already there have been at least 150 instances while the British have been rioting in London. There have been at least 150 instances of arson, of expensive luxury cars in Germany. You can see that there is discontent. It's turning, unfortunately, into xenophobia, into hating the Greeks, hating the Italians, and so on, and generally foreigners. If unemployment starts rising in Germany now, those who are working poor will become unemployed poor, and I think this does not augur well for civilization in Europe.
Meanwhile, we have Sarkozy and Merkel making noises about the need for some kind of Europe-wide economic governance mechanism and even talking about issuing Eurobonds. What do you make of that?
Well, they did say that they are not going, that they talked about Eurobonds very briefly and then rejected it. And instead, they spent an hour and a half in most of their meeting discussing what? Discussing ways of coordinating policy on taxes and introducing some kind of Tobin tax, some kind of financial transactions tax, knowing full well that neither of these two policies are going to go through because the rest of the Eurozone does not agree with their proposals. Effectively, they rehashed certain policies that they agree upon, knowing that the rest of Europe are not going to embrace them. And they were the only two Europeans, 2 days ago when they met, who did not discuss Eurobonds, who did not discuss some rational plan for consolidating, homogenizing debt, and therefore restructuring it. It seems to me that my feeling is that they resembled a fire brigade, which during a mighty bushfire are holding a conference discussing the importance of biodiversity instead of extinguishing the fire. The only good thing that you can say about that meeting of Merkel and Sarkozy was that the expectations of everyone, citizens as well as markets, were so low that no one could possibly be disappointed.
It seems to me that part of the crisis that we're living through is not just economic, but there seems to be a real political crisis and a crisis of leadership and understanding. What do you think?
Well, all crises are a mix of political and economic. The political is economic and the economic is political. Only vulgar economists and unschooled commentators think that they can separate the two. It is a political crisis which began, well, it began. It's impossible to trace its origins, but at least we can say that when in 2008 the financial markets collapsed, it's what we were saying earlier, on both sides of the Atlantic, governments sped to shore up shareholders of banks and creditors, and the result is that they inherited a big debt crisis. The difference between the United States and the European Union, in particular the Eurozone, is that here in Europe we have an even greater political problem than the one you have in the United States. At least you know that in the United States that if this mutual assured destruction between the White House and Congress didn't exist, there would be something that you could do in order to deal with the debt crisis. in Europe, the very structure of the euro system must be changed. The architecture is such that it guarantees that once we've entered this crisis, our politicians cannot do anything to address it except to agree to a rejigging, a redesign of the architecture of the euro. The problem with this is this. I think they're clever enough, smart enough, informed enough to know that. But there is a very worrying a divergence between their narrow political interests and the interests of their own nations and, of course, of the Eurozone as a whole. Let me give you a very brief example. Take Mrs. Merkel, the German Chancellor. She knows that there has to be homogenization of debt, there must be a Europe-wide recapitalization of banks. She understands all that, I have no doubt. She has pretty good advisors who have told her that. But she also knows that doing these things that would end the crisis, or arrest the crisis at least, would mean that her power in the Council of Europe, when she meets the other European leaders, is going to diminish substantially. Because this crisis is enhancing her power. And European continental consolidation of the kind which is necessary in order to avert the crisis, to arrest the crisis, will effectively mean that Germany cannot exit the euro. What gives her power over her colleagues, Mr. Sarkozy and the rest of the European leaders at the moment, is that exit card that she has. That the fact that that everybody knows, amongst the rest of the European leaders, that she can leave the euro. So she's far more interested in preserving that power and not conceding to the Social Democrats who are in opposition in Berlin, than doing something about the crisis. This is a tragedy we face.
I don't know if you saw that Michael Lewis had, the infamous Michael Lewis had another piece in Vanity Fair. This about Germany just came out. And he makes the point that while Germany likes to brag about its own domestic prudence and how they avoided real estate bubbles and credit excesses at home, in fact, they enabled the credit excesses at the periphery, that their banks lent wildly to finance the boom in southern Europe. What do you think of that?
Well, it's completely correct. It's completely correct. You know, when we were lambasting Lehman Brothers for having a leverage ratio of 35 to 1, we ignored the fact that German banks had a leverage ratio of 50 to 1. And indeed, the exposure to the toxic waste of the financial sector of the German and the French banks was much, much greater than that of the United States banks and the British banks. So Germany must be very careful before they throw stones, since they are living in a glass house. And let me add another wrinkle to this story. Greece is being lambasted for corruption. This is quite correct and proper, because there is a great deal of corruption in this. But every corrupt stone you overturn here in Greece, you will find a German company underneath. The greatest scandal in the history of Greece regarding corrupt politicians and bribes pushed at them, sometimes bribes that were not requested by politicians, but bribes that were given to them almost purposefully and pressingly, came from Siemens. And how do we know that? Because it was a court case in the United States that forced Siemens to release documents, and we discovered from Siemens' own documents that almost every politician of almost all parties for 20 years at least, I would say 30 or 40, have been on the payroll of Siemens. There are no white doves in this story.
So finally, what's your prognosis, Dr. Varoufakis? What's the patient's future look like?
It's only been good at the moment. I think the way we're going, the year is history. We have Italy and Spain, as I said before, burning. We have the European Central Bank fighting a losing battle, knowingly. Mr. Trichet is in a state of apoplexy because he knows very well that what he's doing now, buying in the secondary markets bonds from Italian and Spanish bonds, is not going to work, just like it didn't work last year when he was purchasing Portuguese and Irish bonds. If these two states find it hard or increasingly impossible to refinance their 2.2 trillion euros of debt, the only institution that we have set up in Europe in order to bail them out, the European Financial Stability Fund, the EFSF, firstly doesn't have enough money to do it, and secondly, is itself structured like a toxic CBO. So even if it finds the funding to salvage Italy and Spain, it will bring down France, and then it's game over. So there is no light at the end of the tunnel, until and unless Mrs. Merkel and Mr. Sarkozy, instead of discussing the biodiversity of the forest, decide to extinguish the forest fire, and that they can do if they decide to homogenize, to unify, to create something U.S. Treasury bills that are issued by the European Central Bank. They know that that will do the trick. They don't want to do it for their own reasons. They are now party politically based. They are little party leaders, unfortunately, who are completely enthralled by what the bankers are telling them, whose interests are quite different to the interests of their own banks. So we are caught in this spider web of double talk and divergence between the private, narrow-minded political interests of leaders and the interests of the Eurozone as a whole. And from that battle, I think that the Eurozone is losing. Now, I'm not that keen on the Euro. I never was. I was an opponent of the Euro when it came together. But now, it's one thing to say that we should not have had it. It's quite another to say that we should allow it to collapse, because if it collapses, we don't go back to where we were in 1999. We go back to the Stone Age, or at least to a postmodern version of the 1930s. And it seems to me that the way we're heading for a split. We're heading for a surplus countries constituting their own mark, or however they want to name their new currency, that will cause a major recession in their countries. The European ideal will be over, and I very much fear that this augurs really badly for the global economy. The Eurozone is 30% of the global economy. It's perfectly capable of dragging the rest down into the second dip or the double dip.
That was Yiannis Varoufakis, a professor of economics at the University of Athens. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the Gavotte from Bach's Partita No. 3 for solo violin, performed by Henrik Schiering. Till next week, bye.